This is Sagar. How you doing?
Good, buddy. How are you today?
Oh, buddy, I'm great. I'm fantastic. Woke up to, was up early, and I actually went for a early walk and came back and was able to watch the 200-meter race. Andre DeGrasse continues his unbelievable run of meddling in every event he partakes in the Olympics, which is ridiculous in itself. And now he gets the gold medal after having a silver behind Usain Bolt 5 years ago. And I don't know if you saw that race or not, but man, I get fired up watching this. Like the athleticism at the track to me is amazing, but like the sheer out speed and then the, you know, the long distance runners and what they do and how fast they can run. It's mind blowing to me.
Yeah, for sure. I was a little late to the party this morning, but ended up watching it afterwards. And, yeah, he's pretty incredible, the story, eh? And I think I was reading he ran his first race when he was 12. So he just, you know, just unreal that he's basically been meddling every time he steps up. And so knocks out a gold. That's just a huge moment. The 200 is a really fun race, too. Like, I find watching the 100, it's over so quickly. The 200, you've got the corner, and it's a different race to watch. So, yeah, really super exciting, awesome for him. Lots to celebrate at the Olympics so far for Canadian athletes. It's been good, man. I've been enjoying it. Watching a little replay of the golf here now, the women's golf, and enjoying that. A couple Canadians playing. So, yeah, it's all good. It's fun to watch.
Oh, I absolutely love it. And then there's times, and of course, because I'm a numbers nerd, that I'm watching and I'm like I watched Safwan Hassan. And of course, we saw her fall in the 1500 meter heat. Then she gets up and she wins. You're like, oh, that's pretty good. But then I watched her win the 5000 meter Sagar, and she won it in 14 minutes and 36 seconds. And I think for people like, oh, okay, you know, 5000, like, we don't really have that. That really means nothing to most of us. So I broke it down. That means she runs every 100 meters in 17.5 seconds.
So what would the female sprinters run the 100 meter in, I wonder?
About 11. About mid 10s.
Mid 10s. And she ran it an average at 17 seconds?
17.5 seconds doing 50 consecutive 100 meter sprints.
That's insane. That's crazy. Only a drop off of 7 seconds and change per 100 meters.
Yeah.
50 times.
Yeah, and, well, it's not even that. It's for average person right now. If I got a listener say, okay, I want you to go outside right now, warm up properly, and then run 100 meters. I would say half the people can't even run 100 meters in 17.5 seconds. Never mind doing 50 in a row.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the thing. So you go get, you go balls out, and you get in there. Because I know I did it. We had the race a few years ago when the track and field championships were here. And I ran mine, and I trained for that and ran. And I was a decent runner when I was younger. And so I ran mine in 12.8. And I was done. Like, I'm like, oh, my God. So I'm like, there's no chance I could have done the next one in 12. Probably not even in 17. That's the thing, that like the drop off is amazing. Some people might be able to go under 17 for one, maybe two, and then they're done.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty incredible, man. It's the Olympics. I've had the pleasure of covering a few Olympics, but one of my favorites, probably my favorite one that I got to cover. I mean, Vancouver was cool, but I was just primarily on hockey there. But in 2004, I got to go to Athens, and I went there as just a general assignment reporter. So we didn't have the broadcast rights. We weren't broadcasting any of the sports, so I was just there reporting. And basically every day it was like, okay, well, we got two cameras and two reporters, two crews. Where are we going today? And we just paid attention to everything that was going on, and everywhere that Canada had a chance to medal or to you know, in an important qualifier, you just jump in the car with the driver and go blasting across town trying to get there in time. And it was one of my favorite reporting experiences, because in the morning, you know, you race out and you're doing trampoline. And then in the afternoon, oh, we just qualified on the bike track. So now you're busting over to the bike. Oh, now you're heading out to the water because, you know, we had some rowers who did great. And Farhan covered most of the track stuff, which I know he loved doing. But, yeah, there's something about the Olympics as a reporter. It's phenomenal. It was phenomenal to cover it as a general assignment reporter like that.
Oh, yeah, it'd be absolutely
I got to cover. I covered Kyle Schufelt's gold medal in his floor routine there, which was phenomenal. So, yeah, just some really cool, memorable experiences. So you're seeing them live out on TV again now, and it's just having had the chance to be there is very cool.
Ryan Rashog from TSN joins us, and look forward to the women tomorrow night in the big soccer match. We got Damian Warner. Two Canadians are right now first and third, heading into day two at the decathlon. So could be unreal the next few days here for Canada, which is fantastic. We also have the 100-meter relay coming up, which I absolutely love. It's always entertaining to watch. You just see maybe someone drops a baton or something. We'll see. Canada definitely is not a favorite, but they'll be in the running. No pun intended. Now, Shogar, I uncovered some stats today in my Help Me Understand article that really blew my mind.
Okay.
Because I didn't know it was that bad. I knew it was bad. I didn't know it was this bad. So this past season, the there's two records that were set this year, and not good records. First of all, the Anaheim Ducks had the worst power play in NHL history at 8.9%. Like, that's awful. But you know what? To make it even worse, they scored 11 power play goals this year. They allowed 5 shorthanded. So they were plus 6 on the power play. That's the only team in NHL history that's ever been net, single digits. And the second lowest was Detroit, and they were plus 13 this year. So that's kind of funny. And even if I average it out over 82 game season, the worst ratio was plus 18. So the Ducks would have had to be on fire in their final 26 games to break it. They were terrible. But the thing that's concerning to me is Columbus. Columbus this year averaged 2.09 power plays per game. That's the lowest ever. The second lowest, Anaheim this year at 2.20. Buffalo, sixth lowest at 2.55. The Islanders, ninth lowest at 2.57. So in all-time NHL history, four of the top lowest PP per game came this year in the NHL. If the NHL needs anything else to tell them they're not calling the damn rule book, this is it. The game's faster than ever, but magically there's no penalties. Boggles my mind.
Yeah. You know, and I wonder, I always cover all the GM meetings and the Board of Governor meetings and stuff when things are normal and we can get out there. And it feels like this would be one of those years where it was just a huge thing on the agenda, right? Figuring out what to do with the rule book, how they're calling it. But listening to Gary Bettman talking through the Stanley Cup final and such, they seem pretty chill about things. You know, they didn't really seem like a group who felt like fundamental change was needed. Now, they'll take a lot of direction from their Board of Governors, so they're not going to panic if the Board of Governors aren't, and they'll wait and see who has what to say, and if there are a lot of loud voices that are crying for change. And then maybe the league will get a little louder about it, but we talked about it a ton in the playoffs. You know, you point out these statistics now. It seems pretty obvious that there's an issue. I'm just not sure if the people in charge would agree with you that there's an issue or not. Do you get the sense they feel like anything really fundamental needs to change?
Well, it's got to come from the players, right? Like, the players are the ones, they're the ones impacted by this. And the players have the power. And they don't need to grandstand in front of a microphone. They need to have meetings behind closed doors and say, okay, and come with this type of data to say, what are we doing? Right? Like, how can you tell? And I'm not saying they got to go back to levels of 2006. But, Shogar, the team that had the most power play per game this year was Colorado. Right? And there's 1,122 teams all time since they started tracking power plays. Colorado this year, which led the league, they were 703rd highest all time. Not even in the top 60%. So that's the best team. And then you drop down to second because Colorado was quite a bit higher than everyone else. Then it drops down into the 800s and 900s for teams even in the top five. Like, it's so ridiculous. And anybody who watches a game can see that the amount of obstruction and calls that aren't, just call the rule book. Like, it's right there, and they refuse to do it. And why the players accept it, I don't understand.
Now, you took, your data was regular season data, correct?
100%.
So did you feel watching during the regular season like they weren't calling enough and that it wasn't, did you have that same, because it was definitely very much a sentiment in the playoffs.
every game I would see, every game that I watched, I would say at least one blatant call was missed. So I'm like, well, that's a penalty. That's an easy call, hooking, tripping, whatever you want to call it, and they didn't call it. And it didn't matter which game I watched, because I watched a lot of San Jose games this year. I watched actually a lot of the North Division games, right, because it was interesting because there was a lot of rivalry. I watched lots, and every game I could have easily said, here, at the 17-18 mark, that, and I'm not talking like 50% ones, because I'm not a guy who's like, oh, the refs are terrible. I believe the refs do what the league wants. And they're like, hey, we don't want an endless parade to the penalty box. Okay, well, we're not going to call anything. And that's what they do. And then in the playoffs, it's magnified, Shocker, because the emotion's higher and everything means more. But this is a problem that happens all year long. It maybe gets magnified more in the regular season, right? It's like people who are mad at Trump because they think he's the only bad human being on the planet. Well, no. All he did was bring all the issues to the forefront and put him more on a magnifying lens. That's all.
So I think, but I do recall in the playoffs, part of the frustration from the players was the change in standard. And I do agree that there was a change in standard from the regular season to the postseason in terms of the way the referees had established that they were going to call things. So I don't think it's just because it was the bigger stage. Now, the point you're making is even in the regular season, they're not calling enough.
No.
And they need to adjust the standard in the regular season. But then the other issue, even if they do that, is, okay, now what are you going to do in the playoffs? And is there going to be as big a discrepancy between the standards during the regular season and the standards in the playoffs? Do you ref a certain way through an 82-game schedule and then differently in the postseason, as it's kind of always been? Or do they want to close that gap between the way the rule book is called in the regular season and the way that it's called in the playoffs? So I don't know if they agree with you or feel that it needs to change in the regular season. And I'm not sure if they agree with you that the same, you know, that the difference in the standard was there. I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure if the people in charge of this thing feel like this is really high on the priority list to get adjusted or not. You know, and I mean, I guess the players can get loud about it, but at the end of the day, I mean, Gary Bettman, it's the team owners and the product that's on the ice and their ability to sell it and if they're happy with it. And I mean, the Board of Governors, they have a tremendous amount of power. When they're upset about stuff, that gets Gary Bettman's attention.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Well, they should be, if like, especially at a time when you have fans who a lot of them might be having to decide where they're spending their entertainment dollars coming out of COVID, right?
Yeah.
If they have to wait, well, geez, how can we make the game more exciting? Oh, I don't know. I have this really outside the box thinking, Gary. How about we call the rule book? Oh my God, Doug, that's so crazy. It might work. Like, it's unbelievable. I watch all the other leagues, and none of them do this. It's only the NHL. It's the NHL's like, our stars don't. Because, and I'm saying every player matters, but let's be honest. The stars are the ones who deal with most obstruction because they have the puck the most, and they're better than everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely noticeable in Edmonton because we watch McDavid play all the time, and there's always lots of stuff. You know, and he seems to be the, you know, you pay close attention to him, he's always got the puck, and it feels like refs lay off of calling penalties that he would draw because they would just be doing it all the time. That kind of seems like ground zero for the standard, you know, because McDavid definitely could be drawing more penalties than he does every game. So I don't know, man. I don't know if it'll change or not. I don't know when the next meeting is or if that's an agenda topic or not, but it would definitely benefit the Oilers if they called things tighter because they're built with that power play as the kind of the tip of the spear, and it would be a big benefit to them if they did tighten things up and let their guns run.
No, 100%, it would. The CFL season begins tomorrow. The Elks are in action on Saturday. I've been studying and looking at teams just because there's so many changes in the offseason and, you know, seeing the depth charts and everything like that. Now that you've looked at teams' depth chart, Shocker, is there any team you're like, oh, I like this team better all of a sudden?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't dug into it. Sounds like you've sort of dug in a little bit more across the league. I've more been digging into the matchup this weekend because I'm working on the broadcast. So I've been just digging in a little bit more and focusing on that. You know, I would say digging in on Ottawa a little bit here today, like, it's interesting with Matt Nichols at the helm there. I'm really interested to see what kind of year he has. Like, we know him well, right? He was in Edmonton here for a while. And we know at times what he can do and at times what he can't do. and a bit of a chip on the shoulder kind of guy the last couple of years, but it sounds like this year he's trying to put all that behind him. But being given an opportunity to run with it here, I don't know how much there is around him, but it'll be interesting to see what he can do. And for the Elks, let's see if the offense is as good as it feels like it will be. They've got some real nice weapons in place, and all signs point to them being fairly high octane. Did I use the wrong name? Did I say it before? I might have accidentally used the wrong name.
Anyway, it's happened.
Apologies if I did. Elks. Yeah. That'll be my. We'll have a 25-cent jar that we have to pay money to every time we do that this year for the first few weeks.
Oh, dude! First few weeks, man. Spent all the last few months. I don't know how many times I said it, but it was numerous. So I have been better the last 3 weeks.
Good.
Finally. So basically, I have a big sign right in my office here.
Right across. I should put it just across my, the top of my computer screen. But
just put it on your forehead.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Like that works. So do you think, what do you think of Nichols and Ottawa, and can they take a run at the Elks this weekend? Like, I was looking at their team today, and they're being picked. They're down near the bottom of the power rankings. Everyone's kind of writing them off a little bit, and they're a little, they got a bit of a chip on their shoulder about it, but it'll be interesting to see if he can, be consistent and manage the game the way he can and give them a chance.
Everybody has a chance, especially early on in the season when you've had this much time off, right? Matt Nichols is—he's not the most electrifying quarterback, whatsoever, but he can get the job done. But if you're going to get a lot of pressure on him, then he's kind of in a world of hurt. So I'll be curious about both, like the Elks O line and D line. Like if they're good, then the Elks offense should be quite good because they've got weapons on paper that say they're pretty good. And, defensively, their linebacking core, they've revamped their entire secondary. But, my biggest thing is to watch the Elks and see how much of a void there is without Armando Sewell, who had to command a double team on every play. And that allowed the at the time, Esks, now Elks, able to, rush four guys and get pressure because Sewell was forcing guys to double team him on every play.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, you try and bring in some guys and spread things out a little bit, but when you got an impact guy like that that's missing, definitely changes the complexion of things a little bit. It's just been so long. It's been so long. I I'm studying up and I'm sort of, but man, it's been a really long time since these guys have been able to kick this thing off. So I'm interested in a clean slate for these organizations and just to see where it all lands and maybe who's going to surprise us and who's going to kind of silence the critics. How good are the Elks going to be this year? How good is this team? It looks like it could be pretty good, but, it's a short season, 14 games. I'm excited for it. It's going to be fun.
I'm looking forward to it too, Shogger. Have a good one.
Yeah, enjoy the night, pal.